We're talking this afternoon with Mike Vaccaro, who is the author of a new book, The First Fall Classic, The Red Sox, The Giants, and the Cast of Players, Pugs, and Politicos Who Reinvented the World Series in 1912. Good afternoon, Mike.
Hi, Ron. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you very much. Joe Posnanski and Mark Frost each published a book this year about the Red Sox and Reds matchup in 1975, which is an amazing coincidence in itself. But your book follows the Boston club from about 100 years ago. How did you come to pick this as a topic?
You know, I was looking for a World Series that I could kind of dig my fingers into in terms of, you know, one that really hadn't been celebrated in print a lot, you know, which kind of eliminated a lot of the World Series from, say, the 30s on, because, you know, a lot of newsreel footage exists from almost all the World Series from that point on, and a lot of books have been written about Dodgers of the 40s and 50s, for instance, or the 1960 World Series or whatever. So I started going back in time, and I focused on two World Series. And one was the 1926 World Series, Yankees and Cardinals, which featured Grover Cleveland Alexander striking out Tony Lazzari, and Babe Ruth getting caught stealing, and then the World Series, which is you can imagine what the World Series with the brouhaha would be like if Alex Rodriguez had rendered a World Series by getting picked up or something. And it was kind of on the doorstep of the 27 Yankees. Or that was kind of what would have been the underlying story. And it was interesting. And then I really started to kind of look at 1912. And, you know, you look at the World Series that came before 1912, there really wasn't any that was that really captured anyone's imagination. There was one seven-game World Series a few years earlier, but Game 7 was a blowout, so because of that was kind of not interesting. I just started studying the games themselves, and the games of this World Series, I mean, there were eight of them because there was a tie, and the last game of the World Series actually went to extra innings, so you really can't do any better than that in terms of a product on the field. And then when I started to look and see who exactly played in the World Series, I mean, the cast of characters was extraordinary, five Hall of Famers, two Hall of Fame umpires. I mean, it was a remarkable array of characters and personalities, and the more I started to look into it, the more entertaining the whole story seemed to be to me.
Mm-hmm. It's amusing to read about the Red Sox owner, James McAleer.
Yeah, Jimmy McAleer. He was, you know, people tend to think that Harry Frazee was the only bad Red Sox owner they had in the early part of the century, but Harry Frazee kind of looked like the Rooney family compared to Jimmy McAleer.
Now, it's interesting how he tried to manipulate the series to get that extra game back in Boston.
Yeah, he really did. You know, the Red Sox really seized to, you know, they seized out to a 3-1-1 lead with the tie, and they were ready to wrap things up at the Polo Grounds in Game 6, really Game 5, but Game 6 and the six games played. And they had Smokey Joe Wood ready to go, who had already won two games in the World Series. He's won 34 games during the season. And Jimmy McAleer on the train from Boston to New York before the game went up to his manager, Jake Stahl, and essentially talked him out of using Smokey Joe Wood. And he wasn't really talking him out of it. He basically told him, I don't want you to pick Smokey Joe Wood. And he wouldn't say the exact reasons, but it was fairly obvious that that McAleer had stars in his eyes and realized that that if they actually clinched the World Series in Boston at brand-new Fenway Park, it would be a windfall for him. And that was exactly what he expected to have happen. They wound up losing Game 6, but what he didn't expect was that Joe Wood would be pretty angry about this, not only because his pride was hurt, but because he and his brother and a lot of his teammates and a lot of his family's friends had taken the idea of Joe Wood on the mound in Game 6 as the sure thing it was for so much in 1912, and had wagered a pretty tidy sum on the game, and so they took a bath for it. And Joe Wood himself was very unhappy, and, you know, there was a lot of talk about what might have happened in Game 7 back in Boston when he did pitch. His day lasted exactly 13 pitches. He allowed six runs and didn't seem terribly upset by any of them. So there was that level of intrigue that was in the series also, which really kind of added to what I think is a pretty fun story to tell.
Now, you bring up an interesting point. A lot of people think that gambling and throwing games began in 1919 with the Black Sox, but that's not the case, is it?
Hardly. You know, I mean, 1919 is when it exploded, and when you take a real hard look at the way baseball was in the years leading up to it, 1912 being one of those years, it's almost, you understand that what happened with the Black Sox was almost inevitable. It was going to happen at some point. Just focusing on the era that I've been dealing with. I mean, you know, gamblers were and bookmakers were as much a part of the stadium experience as vendors. You know, I mean, if you wanted to buy a program, you wanted to buy some peanuts, you wanted to place a bet in the game, you knew exactly where to go. In the run up to the World Series, you know, players weren't shy about saying what they thought would happen in terms of the odds. I mean, you know, the Red Sox were 10-8 favorites to win the World Series in the parlance of the bookmakers, and the players were more than happy to discuss those odds, which, you know, is kind of funny given our current context. And John McGraw, you know, who was the most famous manager ever up to that point, and certainly, you know, remains in the minds of many one of the best managers ever, he was business partners with Arnold Rothstein, you know, who 7 years later would mastermind the Black Sox scandal, where they owned pool halls together in New York City. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think that they weren't just playing nine ball in those pool halls, you know. So it was, it really was a, you know, there was a distinct level of intrigue attached to these games, and really all of baseball. I mean, baseball and gambling, you know, really went together almost like the horses and OTB do. And today, and people always kind of realized there was always a chance for some untoward activity, and it wasn't until 1919 when it was finally exposed.
Now, is this the first time we're seeing the name Arnold Rothstein writ large like this?
You know, Rothstein was kind of a, in New York City, he was a known underworld figure. In fact, it's interesting, one of the side stories I get into in the book concerns a murder trial, which was kind of a trial of the century. It was at least, you know, it was a young century, but it was certainly labeled a trial of the century in 1912, and it was going on concurrently to the World Series, and it involved a rogue cop named Charles Becker, who had one of his mob guys named Beansy Rosenthal. I mean, these are great, you just can't make these names up. And basically, Beansy Rosenthal and Arnold Rothstein had come up together as small-time hoods who became bigger-time hoods. And the difference between them is that Arnold Rothstein was smart enough to keep his mouth shut, you know, kind of grow legitimate by trying to have, you know, make friends like John McGraw. And Beansy Rosenthal, he loved to shoot his mouth off, and he loved to talk about the scams he was perpetrating, which is part of the reason why he wound up getting put out of business permanently.
Now, the association between ball players and gamblers, after the commissioner, the office of the commissioner began, that was kind of, you look at Leo DeRocher was banned for a year because of his association with gangsters.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, there are a lot of old Hollywood movies where, you know, the guy who's the main character, you can see he go any number of ways. And a lot of ways that they can use to go is he either becomes a gangster or a ball player. and it always seemed like a kind of a cool Hollywood vehicle until you realize that was really the case for a lot of people in the early parts of the century. You know, I mean, sometimes you can also become a cop, I guess. You could also become a priest, maybe, but or a rabbi. But for the most part, it was one way or the other. And ball players and gangsters are really the most notorious or famous people in any given neighborhood in any big city.
Now, obviously, the economics of the ball players had to play into the gambling situations. Of course, the salaries were extremely low in those days. But can you tell us, how is the World Series revenue split?
Well, that was another interesting part of it, Ron, is that this is still the case today. The players' pool, you know, from which you draw the winner's share and the loser's share, is only drawn from the first four games of the World Series. And that's a tradition that goes all the way back to 1905, at the first resumption of the World Series. The owners, you know, to speak plainly, didn't trust the players. There was some talk that the 1903 World Series had been artificially extended because the players just figured the longer you play, the more money we can make. That game had gone to eight games, so they decided that, you know, if you only pay them for the minimum amount of games that a game for the series can go, that there's no motivation to try and add on the series as you go. So that's the reason why they only paid them off the first four games. Now, at the time, the 1904 World Series, it kind of made it a little interesting because the players thought, well, there's only four games being taken to a resolution, but there's five games to make that resolution. We should get paid for all five of those. And the National Commission, which ran the sport then, said that's not how we're going to do things. kind of a vindication of the way that players learn early and often in those days, and you really can't fight City Hall. And it really hurt the players, and the players had actually threatened maybe not to play one of the games as a matter of protest. But you know what? There was no one Marvin Miller to organize them. And, as much as they respected their spokesman, Christy Mathison, they didn't do that.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the process by which you wrote the book. You have two previous books, 1941, The Greatest Year in Sports, and Emperors and Idiots, which is about the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry in more recent years. How has the process changed from this book to those in terms of how you do your research, the ease that you find your material? Can you talk about that a little bit?
No, it's interesting. It's been a definite evolution in the process, only because, like you said, the first book, which was the Red Sox-Yankees book, Emperors and Idiots, at least half of the book was contemporary. I was writing about the 03 and 04 Yankees-Red Sox relationship while also kind of harkening back to all of the prominent things that kind of foreshadowed what came, the 49 pennant and the 78 pennant and so on and so forth, going all the way back to 1903. And so much of that research was done interviewing live people. Obviously, the players who were taking part in the 03 and 04 season, there are still so many players that were alive from 1949. I talked to Dominic DiMaggio, who was still alive at the time, and on. And so that was really kind of like the work I do for the New York Post, where you talk to live bodies and you report what they say. 41 was a little more challenging because you're dealing with a lot earlier time. A lot of the people that I was writing about at that time had already passed away. So you're talking to their relatives. You were dealing with their archives, their diaries. And some people were still alive, and that certainly was helpful. Dominic DiMaggio again was very helpful for that, obviously, because in 41, both his brother and his teammate Ted Williams. Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams were involved in making 1941 so special, so that was one thing. But the 1912 World Series, obviously, in the entire course of my research, I talked to one person who actually saw a game, and that was somebody who had been a six-year-old fan in 1912, and you can imagine that when I talked to him, he was 102 years old, and he was fascinating to talk to. But not terribly helpful. There's only so much that a fan can tell you about the inner workings of a World Series. I was able to glean a little bit about what it was like to be in the stands in those games, and it was certainly nice to talk to the gentleman. But there was obviously the principal players were around, so what I had to rely on were primarily newspaper accounts of the time, and it's amazing how much resource material there was with that. Because there were 14 daily newspapers in New York City alone, there were six in Boston. Everybody who played tended to ghostwrite a column, so you really got pretty much everything that everybody was thinking every moment of the day, day to day during the World Series. And the Hall of Fame is a treasure trove of diaries and journals and stuff like that. If you know what you're looking for when you go there, it's amazing how much cool stuff you can uncover when you go to Cooperstown.
Mm-hmm. You also, speaking about all the newspapers, all the material you had, you are very honest about the way you recreated the dialogue.
Yeah, I tried very hard to make it to where every time that there was I won't say a discrepancy, but if there's something that it's discovered, in the way that somebody talked about a situation, the way people talked about certain things, I tried very hard to get two accounts of it. Well, that wasn't possible, and there were times where it was just impossible. I just kind of relied on my own, having been around these guys, theoretically or virtually, for so long, and I tried to be as honest as I could to what those conversations were probably like. But for the most part, what these are recreations that the players themselves recounted in their own newspaper columns, 97 years ago.
Do you ever think about what it would have been like to be a sports writer in those days?
Oh, all the time. In fact, one of the great narcotics, for lack of a better word, from doing the book at that time, about that time, is when you really get involved in reading the contemporary accounts, you're talking about some of the greatest sports writers of all time who were at the peak of their powers, and Grantland Rice and Damon Runyon and Fred Lieb and so forth. And so it was really kind of an honor to read their accounts of this stuff. And as I'm writing the book, as I said, the narcotic is, as you're writing, you almost feel like you're descending into this black and white world where you're wearing a fedora and clacking on an old typewriter and chomping on a cigar. I mean, when you get to that point, I mean, it almost sounds surreal, but it's actually very true. And that's when I know I have a pretty compelling subject, when I find myself getting involved in it. I can promise you that as I was writing this, the one thing I kept thinking to myself is, man, I would really love to have covered this World Series.
Very good. All right, we've been talking with Mike Vaccaro, the author of the First World Classic, about the 1912 World Series between the Red Sox and the New York Giants. Thanks a lot for your time, Mike.
Hey, it's great talking to you, Ron. Thanks for having me on.